Hi, I'm Russ Kunkel, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me today, this is the first time I've ever done something like this. Normally when I interview someone, it's a one-on-one interview, but I wanted to do something a little bit different today. So I've got the entire immediate family band in the Zoom room. We've got Russ Kunkel. Say hello, Russ.
Hey, how you doing, everybody?
We got Leland Sklar.
I'm here with you.
Steve Postel.
Hello, hello.
Danny Cooch Korchmar.
Hello.
And Wadi Wachtel.
Hello, Pat.
Nice to see you guys. All right.
We got
to
go now. Sorry.
Well, that look, if you had to go now, it was still a thrill, and I appreciate it. First of all, the reason you guys are here is you got a new album out. I'll hold it up. It's Slippin' and Slidin'. It's an EP. And this thing just debuted at number 6 on the Billboard chart for blues albums. You guys have got to feel pretty great about that. I mean,
well, we do, of course.
I mean,
we're glad to be anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, look, 50 years, basically 50 years in the business, you guys have been making a living in music, and to, you know, still have the love from your fans and the music buying public, especially when it's, you know, it's hard to chart anything now in music. So congratulations, guys. Applause on that. Great job.
Thank you very much.
So this is an EP. Is there going to be a full album down the road?
We finished our album, but because of the world disease situation, everything's been put on hold and everything's on the back burner. So our record was actually scheduled to come out this month, along with the documentary that's being done about us by Denny Tedesco. But everything is on back burners now, so we're not really sure when the record will come out.
All righty. And Danny Tedesco has been on the show before when he had his the Wrecking Crew documentary. So he's doing a documentary on you guys and everything you've done since the beginning.
Yeah.
That's going to be incredible. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to start with you, Steve, because for me, you're the new guy. I know these other four guys, and I don't know as much about you, but I want to give everyone a little bit on Steve right now. So we know, Steve, you've been a touring musician, a session musician. You've played with David Crosby, Jennifer Warnes, Michael McDonald, John Oates, Robin Ford, and that's just to name a couple. You've also, you recorded and mixed the final performances by Ravi Shankar. You've scored some movies, some documentaries. And, you know, you have solo albums in your own right, including Time Still Knocking. And I want to tell you that I love the song Long Way Home on that album.
There was thunder in the darkness and the fire down below. We were lost without a compass, nowhere left to go. Had a dream, it was forsaken for a change in circumstance. Maybe all that we need. One more chance, cause it's a long way home. Oh, such a long way home. This is a light in the distance, making our way back home.
For me, and for maybe some of our other listeners, welcome, and it's nice to meet you, Steve. How did you get hooked up with these four guys?
It's all Danny Korchmar's fault.
But, he gave us a lot of money.
It came about really, that record you're talking about, Time Still Knocking, was on Emergent Records. And while I was making that record, I met Mr. Leland Sklar. I grabbed him at the NAMM show and forced him to play on my record. I had a mutual friend with Waddy. Waddy played on a song. And so, and then Russ's son, Nathaniel Kunkel, ended up mixing the record.
Oh, nice. Okay, cool.
Nathaniel invited me to the Troubadour show, and with the reunion show with Carole King and James Taylor.
Yeah.
And at the Troubadour show, I met Russ, dad from Nathaniel, and then I met Danny, and we connected. And when Danny moved out here, we started working together. And that's sort of my entry into this amazing cast of characters.
And do you guys feel like an immediate family? Like, is there a brotherhood? Like, especially the four guys from long ago? Like, do you guys feel like family? Like Leland, if you needed yes. something in the middle of the night, could you call one of these guys on the phone and they'd be there for you?
Absolutely not.
Of course not.
But if they called me, I would be there.
Okay.
Now, so Cooch came up with the name The Immediate Family, and it is the most aptly named band you could have ever imagined. I mean, to think that we've been playing music together for 50 years, and words have never passed between us that weren't complimentary, supportive, caring. I've never known a group of men who I love more than these guys. It's a remarkable relationship we have, where you hear so many bands that are, you know, they're successful musically, but they're always fighting, and they yeah. travel in different buses, and they don't. We really have an immediate family brotherhood, and I'm really proud to be associated with these guys on any level. And if they need anything, they know my answering service number.
Very nice. Before we started to record, someone brought up The Section. Was there any thought to just using that name for this band?
No, none at all.
None at all.
This is a totally different entity. What's completely, it's part of our lineage to how we got here, but it was very, very different than this.
Now, I had the pleasure of seeing you guys pre-COVID at Bogey's in Westlake Village in December.
Oh, wow.
That was a thrill for me, first of all, because I didn't even know you guys were performing. I like stumbled across it like on the internet. All of a sudden I'm like, wait a minute, Lee and Waddy and Cooch and Russ are playing at Westlake Village. I live in Woodland Hills, so I'm in Westlake Village in, you know, 20 minutes. So I was like, I just told my wife, I go, I'm going to a concert tonight. She's like, it's Christmas. What do you mean you're going to a concert tonight? And I said, you don't understand. These are legends. I have to go to this. So
Santa's gonna be there.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I took a picture. I brought it. I go, see, Santa was on base. Your press person, and is Lisa Roy? How is she your manager, Cooch?
She's not our manager. She helps us with press. She's
yes.
a brilliant consultant, music consultant. She's great with our press, and fortunately, we're very lucky to have her on yeah. our team, helping us with our press releases. Yeah.
And Lisa set me up with some tickets, and she was fantastic when I got there. I got to say hi to you guys, and you guys were all super nice, and that was a real thrill. So, and the show was amazing, and I think, Danny, you're the one that said, we're a cover band, but we play all our own material. So,
yep.
Fantastic. This question is for Waddy. Waddy, you got three guitar players and you got three vocalists here. When you go into the studio, how do you decide who's going to play the solo?
Well, usually it's the guy who wrote the song really usually has the kind of the first say of that, you know. And then we ignore what he wants to do and figure out who's got a good idea to play a solo. But it works out pretty well. Yeah, Danny's songs, a lot of times Danny will, you know, let me blast leads while he's singing. So that works out, and vice versa. You know, we split them up surprisingly easily.
Oh, well, that's okay.
It can get to be a nightmare with three necks up there, but it works out very smoothly, actually. Danny and I have been playing with each other for so long. We know where the other guy isn't going to be.
Yeah.
And Steve has such a different style than either of us that what he does fits right in between where we are. So it's really very cool.
And then when
we don't listen to him anyway, so it doesn't matter.
And when I saw the band live, I assumed that maybe Steve was going to be singing lead on all the songs and you guys were the backing band, but that's not true. You guys are all, you know, the three guitar players are all handling vocals. Steve, how do we decide who sings lead on these songs? Is it also a songwriter gets first choice?
I would say that most of it's songwriter, but then there's instances where, like, there's a couple of great songs that Danny wrote with Don Henley, and Don Henley has a higher voice, and it just seems more natural for me to sing it. All this stuff, as they said, it's amazingly organic. I mean, there's a song that Danny and I ended up singing in harmony, because that's and it's just whatever's best. It's all about what's the best thing for this piece of music, and because we all have different styles and skill sets, it kind of works itself out. They can always just turn me down, so that
yeah,
works.
Exactly.
And that's the smart way to go. If you're all on board with whatever services the material the best, that's the way to go. If you start getting egos involved, then that's not going to be good. So that's cool that you guys musically are all on the same page. Peter Asher was on the show about a month and a half ago, and I told him this same story, but I have to tell you guys too. The first time I ever saw the name Leland Sklar, Russ Kunkel, and Danny Kortchmar was on James Taylor's JT album. Your Smiling Face was the first, as a 13-year-old kid, that was the first 45 single I ever purchased. That song is, to this day, I love it. It starts out with Russ, immediately we hear drums, bass comes in, then the guitar riff, and we're off and running. And I never get tired of Your Smiling Face.
Whenever I see your smiling face, I have to smile myself, because I love you. Yes, I do. Give me that pretty little pout, it turns me inside out. There's something about you, baby, I don't know. Isn't it amazing a man like me can feel this way? Tell me how much longer, it will grow stronger every day. Oh, how much longer, I thought I was in love.
That is a great album. You guys are on point for that entire record. So, bravo.
Thank you.
When you're making an album like that, because I think it's James's second most popular or most, you know, highest selling album after Sweet Baby James, do you know you're making something special, or is it just feel like business as usual? Russ, do you want to answer that one?
Sure. I'd like to start out by saying one of the main reasons why that album in particular, and of course, you know, James's previous albums are so iconic, is because of the great producer that produced those records, Peter Asher. And he is, if there was a sixth member of this band, it would be Peter, you know, because he has been so influential in all of our careers. And just for instance, on the JT album, we were running on, you know, 16 cylinders then. The band had toured previously many years, and when we went into the studio, it was a well-oiled machine, you know, and James was the artist, and we just did everything we could to play the right accompaniment for him. And Peter, being at the helm, you know, made sure that, you know, it was done in a professional way. So, and in hindsight, you know, it's 2020, you know, looking back on the success of those records, you know, I think at the time, I know for myself, I was just happy to be working and happy to be playing with these knuckleheads. But I think we all pinch ourselves when we look back in time and see what a great body of work we've been a part of.
Yeah. And Peter, when he talked about this album, he was very, very humble with whatever his contribution was. He wasn't taking a lot of credit. That was sweet. But I gave him credit because, you know, the producer's keeping you guys in line, right?
Absolutely right.
Danny, you have a song you wrote on that album, Honey Don't Leave LA, which is a killer track.
To a T. If all that you want to that big chateau where you want to go. In the south of France, gonna end a big romance. Don't you do it. Honey, don't leave L.A. That Riviera's so far away. Making you see the place you play, baby.
How does that work when you're working with a solo artist like James Taylor? Is he asking, does anyone have songs, or are you so comfortable with him that at that time that you were able to just say, hey, I've got this song I'd like you to check out?
More like that. More like your second statement, you know.
Okay.
And James and Peter were very open to all kinds of stuff. When I had Honey, Don't Leave L.A., I thought James would, you know, sing the hell out of this tune. So I played it for James and Peter, and sure enough, we ended up cutting it that day, I think. We cut it the same day I played it for him.
It's a great one. Not one bad song on that album. Again, I want to talk about, I want to get back to the immediate family. I kind of just went off on a tangent, but again, the album Slipping and Sliding. We have three original songs on here that you guys wrote specifically for the album. Then you guys do a cover of New York Minute, which Danny, you co-wrote with Don Henley. You do a cover of Werewolves of London, which Waddy co-wrote with Warren Zevon. Why not five originals? Why did you guys feel like you wanted to put some of the old tunes on? Did you just want to put your own stamp on it? And I'll ask Waddy that question.
We were very concerned that, you know, we, like I said, we have this album sitting there waiting to go. And if we were to start pulling the songs from the album, by the time next summer comes around, that album would be, we would have filleted it out already.
Gotcha.
You know, so the idea was to put out a couple of the new ones that were written specifically for now, and then put in a few that we love doing for people. And, you know, there's the great version of New York Minute, and it's a live version of Werewolves. And they're both really totally valid and very cool, and people really dig hearing them. So, you know, rather than pull the new material off the record, we want to try to preserve the new stuff as long as we can. Otherwise, we won't have an album to release.
That makes sense. So you didn't want to burn songs that you had written. So we'll give you a little taste of what we do live and a cover. So yeah, that's good. Okay, that makes total sense. Now, this album's number six on the blues chart. When I listen to the album, Cruel Twist is the only one that's kind of bluesy for me.
Stepped on a lot of toes, and you broke a lot of hearts, and you rubbed up and down against a lot of people's body parts. You thought that loving would be good for you, all that loving, and you still feel blue. You think about the life you missed, it's such a cruel twist. Such a cruel twist. Such a cruel, cruel twist. Such a cruel twist. Such a cruel, cruel twist.
How did you guys manage to get into the blues category? Steve, do you want to take that one?
You'd probably have to call the powers that be, the people who wear the suits and make these decisions. Yep. I mean, I understand that Cruel Twist is a sort of blues tune, essentially. The rest are rock and roll songs.
Yeah.
But rock and roll, it came from blues.
Sure.
Let's face it. without blues, there's no rock and roll, and we're a guitar-oriented band, and probably a lot of people think that's blues. And also, we all have the blues.
Well, we have the blues now because we're still in lockdown.
Well, I can imagine a bunch of guys sitting around a table at Billboard. You know, they probably have these meetings where they listen to new releases, right? And I can just see them being, you know, befuddled by what category do we put this in? You know, and the blues probably was the one that fit the bill the easiest.
Yeah, well, I mean, that makes sense. But again, just for me, you guys are rock and roll, but you did blue. Yep. You do blues great, too.
Thanks. Slippin' and Slidin', that song has a pretty much of a blues an underbelly to it.
Yeah.
It's pretty funky and pretty downstairs with the acoustic slide and just where that song is coming from. It's pretty blue, that one. Pretty dark.
Russ, you've played with many bass players throughout your career. What's different when you play with Leland?
I've played with Leland more than any other bass player in my career, even though I played with lots of other ones. You know, we've been playing music together for a really, really long time. And just like Waddy was explaining about him playing with Danny, you know, knowing what the other one isn't doing, it's the same simpatico with Leland and I. You know, I know what he's going to do just a second before he does it. And he knows exactly where I'm going to land 2 seconds before I do it. So we always end up in the same place. The answer being, we've worked together so much.
Gotcha.
That it's just second nature. Yeah.
And Leland, how long did it take for that second nature thing to click in with you and Russ?
A second. I mean, it was amazing. The first time we ever played together, it felt like I went as soon as I played with Russ, I felt like I had known this guy all my life. And it was the most natural thing I've ever felt. That's really been the beauty of this entire situation with us is it's been effortless. Everybody came to the table deeply prepared. Everybody's, you know, it's called playing, but we're very, very serious about our music. And the first time any of us, first time I played with Waddy, first time I played with Cooch or Steve and stuff, it just felt right. And Russ, for me, was like the easiest fit of any drummer I've ever known in my life. I've worked with lots of drummers, but there's just something that he could be in one room and I could be in another room, only listening to a click track and maybe looking at a chord sheet. And I guarantee you, when you come in and listen to the playback, we would be catching everything together.
Excellent.
And it's a really natural thing. And plus, I love cuddling with him. He's really a good cuddler.
And he's so sweet.
Yeah, he's affectionate to a fault.
If I can make just say something.
About absolutely,
that,
Steve.
That for me and for us playing with the two of them has the same. That rhythm section is so it's so obvious where things are that it just it makes it really beautiful to flow. Within, like their thing is so beautifully strong that it impacts everything else in this very organic way.
And when I saw you guys live, you know, sometimes when I go see a veteran artist, they seem to have slowed down a little bit, but the five of you were still playing full out, hard, fast, whatever you needed to do. And you guys just looked like you were, you know, just feeding off the energy. And I would assume the playing the music keeps you young, and that's why none of you guys have retired yet. Waddy, is that true?
It's very, very true, yeah. And also, the other aspect of it is that we've played with all kinds of different people and different types of music, but this is a rock and roll band, and that's what this is about. So that energy that we live off of and we try to project to everybody is not coming from folk music, and it ain't coming from ballads. It's coming from fucking rock and roll music, and that's why it's going to be as strong, as loud as possible, and as precise and rocking as possible. It's definitely, that's the format.
All right.
You know, I learned a while ago, you know, you set out to do an album, and you got one song that's like this, you got this kind of a country song, then you got this beautiful ballad, you got a couple of up-tempo tunes, and someone said to me, you know, what do you do? You know, I get the fact that you want to show all these aspects, but for example, you know, AC/DC, you know what they do.
Right.
They do one type of music.
Yeah.
And even though we write different types of songs, they're all coming from around.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Rock and roll point of view.
Gotcha.
And even our pretty ballads and stuff are that way. You know, they're delivered like that rather than like, you know, like that. It's like that, you know. That's the difference. This is a rock and roll band.
Danny, this question is for you. This is about the Running on Empty album. When you and Russ and Leland were touring with Jackson Browne in 1977, did you know that he was recording those songs and that he was going to release those as a live album? Or did you guys think that you guys were just working the new material out and you were going to take it into the studio?
No, we knew it was going to be a live album.
Okay.
Jackson had talked to us about it. We knew exactly what was going to happen. We knew it was going to be a live album. I shouldn't say we knew what was going to happen because a lot of stuff happened that we never could have foreseen. But right. It was obvious it was going to be a new album. And Jackson, being the fearless guy he is, he wanted to present new material live, bang. And we did it, you know. And he presented it like it was his hits. And people responded to those songs like they'd already heard them, amazingly.
Yeah, it's a pretty unique album in that way, where these are all new songs. We've never heard these Jackson Browne recordings before, but just recorded in a live setting. And so, yeah, that's rare. I don't know that anyone's ever done it since.
It was very bold.
And wildly successful. You know, amazing. Yeah. And the performances are stellar on that record. It's still, I was listening to it just yesterday, and still sounds great. Bravo. How many times can I say bravo? But good job, guys. Waddy, just a fun question. Who's easier to work with, Adam Sandler or James Taylor?
Well,
we're waiting.
It depends what year you're speaking of a James Taylor.
All right.
And Adam is
fired by.
What?
Who have you been hired by?
Yeah, right. Who's hiring these days? I can't answer that.
Okay, is it just for fun?
They're both extraordinary, you know.
It elicited the response I had hoped, which was some giggles. So that was good.
Born in 1935 in Brooklyn, New York, the son of Anna and Phil. At 19 years old, he married my mother, Judy, and immediately paid his first Bloomingdale's bill. Right away they started on a family. Three smart kids popped out of mom's tummy. But then one steamy night, dad forgot to wear his raincoat. 9 months later, out came the dummy. But he took care of me. Ah, Stan the Man was my hero. The coolest guy ever, I swear. He stayed up all night making me a clay volcano. That's how I won the science fair.
On a serious question, Waddy, on this album, you guys do the Werewolves of London, and you throw out the line, "We've all been fired by James Taylor." Have you really all been fired by James Taylor?
Except for Steve, yeah.
Oh, and except for Steve.
He's been fired too.
We don't know that. I may have been also. So.
Yeah, he's about to get canned by him too. But no, it is true. Yeah,
okay.
It's true.
Because Leland, when I heard that on the record, I thought, well, that's tongue in cheek. They've been not asked back for projects, but they haven't been fired. But
there's a difference.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. That's true. Okay.
Besides, not being asked back was too many words.
I do have to tell you one thing, though. I'm really digging the nail polish. I think you should keep
it. I should keep rocking it. I keep forgetting that it's on there.
I'm really digging it.
Last year, my daughter wanted to go get her toenails painted, and I took her, and then she said, "Why don't you get your toenails painted too?" And I said, "Okay." So I did. And every time I stepped in the shower and looked down, I would jump because I wasn't expecting to see it. I kept thinking I had a fungus on my feet. So that's how I kind of feel about this right now. I'm glad you're digging it. No one else has this today, though, right? Just me? All right.
Just you.
Leland, you've played on, I think, 2,600 albums, which is, that's like Steve Lukather type credits. That's incredible.
Luke's just beginning.
Yeah, he's young.
Yeah, he's young. When you tour with a band like Toto, when you step in to the position that David Hungate or Mike Porcaro held, how do you play those songs but make it your own? You just don't want to repeat exactly what they were doing.
Well, the thing is, David and Mike and I, we all had kind of similar styles. So it wasn't like I was coming in following Bootsy Collins and trying to cover.
All right. Like,
but the thing I did with when the first time I toured with Toto, I had 5 days to learn their show. So what I did is I immersed myself, and it was mostly Mike. They gave me a live show that Mike Porcaro had been playing.
Okay.
So I tried to honor that as close as I possibly could when I was learning the songs so that there would be no like abrupt changes for the rest of the band. But by the time we were about a month into the tour, then I was injecting kind of the way I would have played the songs, but it happened in a very gradual way. So, and plus the first time I worked with Luke, he was 19 years old. So, I mean, we've been friends and work together forever. So, and I knew all the guys in the band. So it was pretty easy with that.
Gotcha.
But it's really honoring the songs and really listening to how they were doing them and, you know, not changing it up, but eventually throwing my lack of personality into them.
Yeah. I would think that when you step into a gig like that, that you don't want to just feel like you're just, you know, the bass player in a Toto cover band. So I like how you said after a while you would inject your own self into the songs. That's cool.
Yeah, and also, and when I've done live gigs, I never use charts. I always learn the material, because to me, if you go up there and people aren't familiar with you, and you're suddenly up there, got a music stand in front of you, you look like hired help.
Right.
So I really commit myself to learning the material so that when I walk out there, I can take the stage and plant my feet and not look like somebody didn't make it tonight and they found some guy down in the alley.
Russ, this is a question for you as far as session work goes, because I'm always curious about how it works with the drummers. When you get hired to come in to play on a song, the drum parts aren't written out for you, are they? How does it work? Do you improvise? Are you given room to just improvise your parts?
Pretty much, yeah. Most of the sessions that I've done, there's just chord charts.
Okay.
So you kind of know your way. It's a roadmap through the song. I might, and usually we listen to a demo or some sort of recording of the song, and I'll make some notes on my chart as to places that I want to pay attention to. But for the most part, I just wait for, the muse to shower me with some ideas of things to play. And for the most part, I try to play things that I've never played before, try to come up with something unique.
And so you would decide when you wanted to insert a drum fill or all that kind of stuff.
Pretty much, until someone puts the clamp on it, mm-hmm. and says, don't do that. But I try to be tasteful so that doesn't occur a whole lot.
Now, my next question, Russ, I don't want to cause trouble, but why doesn't a drummer get some songwriting credit if he's creating part of the song?
First of all, I am a songwriter.
And right.
I happen to be in a band with really good songwriters.
Right.
So I'm sure I'll be involved in the writing going forward, But sometimes I think drum parts really are important for a character of a song, for how it's memorable. So, but being a songwriter myself, I'm kind of on both sides of the fence of that.
Gotcha. And I didn't necessarily mean with these four other guys. I meant like when you're called into a session and you're doing some hard work on a song that you've just heard, a few times and you're making it, into something more. I always just feel the drummers should get more songwriting credit, but I don't know. What do I know?
I'll say this: knowing what it takes and the work and and the sweat that it takes to go into writing a really good song, and that's a lot of work. And the songwriters deserve the writers and the publishing for that.
Okay.
Just because a drummer comes up with a lick doesn't mean they've worked as hard as the writers.
Gotcha. Okay. Danny, I want to go to you. I want to ask you a question. You've had, wild success working with Don Henley on his first few solo albums. Would you consider him, or you can tell me who's your greatest musical collaborator throughout your career?
I'd say these guys.
All right, great.
The band, the Immediate Family. That's
excellent.
My favorite, for sure.
It's your favorite.
No, but I'd also have to say it was you know, I work with so many genius level talents. We all have. So it'd be hard to pick one out. Working with Henley was great, and we had a lot of fun together. And it was definitely a collaboration because we co-wrote most of the songs.
Yes, she did.
And co-produced it all. So, you know, that was a terrific collaboration. But all of them, every opportunity I've had to play with, the incredible talent that I've been lucky enough to play with, they're all brilliant. And so it'd be hard to pick one out over the other.
But you do, you have co-writing credits on some big hits with Don, and then one of my favorite Jackson Browne songs, Somebody's Baby. Fantastic. So, you know, doing my research, I started to realize, wow, Cooch really, he's got a lot of songwriting credits on these things. So, I mean, I'm impressive body of work.
That's why he always buys dinner.
Because the mailbox money, Russ, is that why?
He didn't say where we eat dinner.
He's very generous.
Right.
Now, I'm going to go around in a circle. I want you guys to tell me a little bit about Linda Ronstadt and when you guys would work with Linda Ronstadt, because for just a music fan and a listener, I would feel like Linda's first take, it wouldn't get better than that in the studio. Like, how do you get better than that voice? Let's start with Leland on that one.
You don't get better than that. She's one of the greatest voices of the generation or generations.
Yeah.
A fabulous artist. But one of my favorite moments with Linda, if you have time for a little anecdotal thing, we were doing an album at the site up above San Francisco with her, and she's a voracious knitter, and she was knitting every day, you know, just like working away. And then one of the days I walk in and she was sitting working like this. And I said, what's going on? She says, well, my eyes are bothering me today. I can't see as well. And she looked up and one of the lenses had fallen out of her glasses and she didn't know it. So she was like sitting and knitting. So we went and found the lens was in the vocal booth and put it in. Then she was sitting back knitting again. She's such a character. It's unbelievable.
My mama told me when rumors spread, there's truth somewhere and I should use my
Waddy, what about you? What can you tell us about Linda Ronstadt and that amazing voice? Like, would she be satisfied, Waddy, with her first take, or was she a taskmaster on herself?
We did surprisingly not many takes on some of those huge hits. And the other thing about Linda is those vocals you're hearing are the take. You know, a lot of times you'll do a record with somebody and they'll have a guide vocal. So, you know, either the artist will just sing a kind of a lackadaisical version of it because they know they're going to sing it. And again, this reflects on Peter Asher's approach, what he wanted us. Those songs are live in the studio. Blue Bayou, that's her live vocal on that record. And the same with That'll Be the Day, same with all the hits. Those are all live takes. So those are complete takes. And I don't know if they were first takes, but they're not, you know, they were never dwelling on take after take after take. Ooh, Baby, that beautiful ballad, Russell plays on that with me and Dave Sanborn, I think was on the date as well. And Linda and these two great singers, that's all live vocals, you know. She was astounding. She didn't need more than a couple of takes. And fortunately, we were good and ready enough to be there solid behind her.
And just so the listener knows, when you say a live take, you don't mean that they were piecing lines together after the fact.
No. It was like a performance. Yes. It was not like a performance. It was literally a performance of the song. The band played everything you heard on Blue Bayou was played when she sang that vocal.
Gotcha.
From start to finish. There were no punch-ins, there were no pickups, you know, nobody, there weren't any fixes on it even. It's just, it's a performance rather than a
process.
A process, yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
So Danny, when you're in the studio with Linda Ronstadt and you know, it's time to record, in your head, do you think, well, this is Linda, so this is going to be an easy day because she's going to nail it?
And I don't think that way. That's not.
How do you? Well, tell me how you think.
Well, there are no easy days and there's no hard days. Every day in the studio, if you're going in to play with your brothers and you play with an artist like Ronstadt, it's a great day.
Okay.
It can never be anything but a great day, of course. Yeah. You know, just listening to her sing, being in the same room with her and being able to play music with her is such an amazing treat. I mean, she's phenomenal, man. Let me tell you, she is off the charts great. I mean, we all know she's great, but when you go play with her, you realize how amazing she really is.
Guys aren't retiring ever, because I feel like when musicians retire, that's when it's over. That's when life ends. And you guys are still I can see it in your eyes. You guys are still vital and full of life and passion and love for this music. Has retirement ever crossed your mind at all?
Why would you retire for something you absolutely love?
Exactly.
Something that's so much a part of you. You know, why do you not start playing guitar when we were 10 years old? It's not going to stop. There's nothing going to stop. You don't stop. You can't, you know. And so retirement is not a word that comes in, I think, with most musicians.
It's not an option.
Right. I'll tell you what, though. The only way retirement kind of gets into the game for me is I'm retiring to do just this band.
Gotcha.
That's
you're full on in the immediate family. This is it.
Yeah, this is it.
And Russ, how, because the drummer, that's a taxing job. I'm not saying the other performers, it's not taxing, but the drummer, it's physical.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
It's more physical sometimes. How do you stay fit? How do you keep going?
Well, I swim a lot, and I still surf, which being active, no matter what your job is,
it helps you
to stay fit. I try to eat good. And, you know, I just want to make sure that when these guys need me, I'm going to be there, you know, so it's important to me. You know, one thing I wanted to say about Linda Ronstadt, which I thought Waddy would have said, is she's a rocker, you know, from Jump Street. And I would put her in the category of a Frank Sinatra. I mean, she is, you know, she's one of the voices of all time. So.
And yet she's a rocker, and yet she can sing anything, all types of music, and not just sing it. She lives it. She sells it. It's not just like, oh, I think I'll sing country now, or I think I'll do some standards. No, she can do it. She can do all of it. It's incredible.
I never played with it, but she taught Waddy how to microwave a hot dog, and he taught me. So I've sort of, some of that knowledge has been passed on to me as well.
It's a little road knowledge. You know, the thing about her also is that we're used to hearing her belt songs out.
Yeah.
You know, she's the loudest. I mean, standing next to her singing, you can't hear anything but her. She's unbelievably loud. And I told her this when we started working together, that when she sings softly, it's the most gorgeous sound that's ever been on the planet. Like it's that song, Think I'm Gonna Love You for a Long, Long Time. Just listen to the first two lines of that song. It's the most breathtakingly gorgeous thing you've ever heard. And I told her this. I said, by the third line, you're blasting again.
Love will abide. Take things in stride. Sounds like good advice, but there's no one in my sight. And time washes clean. Unseen. That's what someone told me, but I don't know what it means, 'cause I've done everything I know to try and make you mine, and I think
but those first two lines, it's incredible how delicate and beautiful that sound is that she makes when she sings softly. The world is crying, man. It's frightening.
She also commits deeply. I think when she did La Boheme, she studied Italian because she really wanted to understand what she was singing. You know, I mean, a lot of singers will just go through the motions of it, but she goes way under the surface on every one of the genres that she does.
Yeah.
Deeply committed every time.
Completely.
Yeah, there's not a lot of singers that can make you bang your head 1 minute and then you have chills on your arm the next minute. And that would be Linda Ronstadt for me.
Yeah.
Steve, you're working in a band situation after, you know, being a solo guy. How's that transition going for you?
Well, I've always had bands.
Right, right. But it's been under your name. You know what I mean? Now this is a band.
But for me, the ultimate bands for me were, like, of course, the Beatles, and then the band Little Feat, and the idea of being in a band where everyone in the band was a complete, like, personality and someone who would inspire me everywhere I looked was a dream of mine. Like, because that's what influenced, that's what I wanted.
Yeah.
Those were the bands I loved, the Stones. Everyone was a unique, powerful. And so that's what this is. I look around and I'm musically, personally, this is what, to me, the idea of a great band is this.
Gotcha. Leland, yes. as a bass player, why the bass? Why did you choose the bass? And who were some of the artists that you looked to that made you want to play bass?
Well, the bass came to me. I started as a classical pianist when I was a kid. And when I entered junior high school, I assumed I'd be the piano player. And they had a plethora of young piano players, but they needed a string bass player. And the music teacher who I owe basically my entire career to, his name was Ted Lynn, brought out an old K upright and put it in my hands, and I plucked one note and felt that vibration, and I said, sold. I said, I'm there. I left the piano at that point and focused, had several different teachers over the years. And, you know, for me, I was kind of a jazz classical snob for the most part. And I was, like, into Ray Brown and Red Callender and Mingus, listened to all of those guys. But it really wasn't until the Beatles hit that my life changed dramatically. And then my dad took me to the Musicians Union on Vine Street, because Stein on Vine used to actually be in the building of the Musicians Union, and bought me a Melody bass and a St. George amp, and I was electric and never looked back. And but all, there's so many influences. To me, almost anybody that picks up a bass can be an influence. It doesn't have to be a monster chops person. Sometimes the neophytes, I learn more from them, because I've forgotten so many of those things about just getting back to simplicity and things, rather than just sitting there doing all kinds of crap. So I, you know, I enjoy it all, you know, but there's always been the Jack Bruces and Entwistles and Bob Mosley and so many wonderful, Jack Cassidy, so many great bass players. But you know, there's, you know, you turn on YouTube and you're going to see nothing but monstrous musicians everywhere. I'm just grateful to be at this end of my career rather than starting now.
Danny, you said that you picked up guitar at 10 years old. Were you from a musical family? What got you interested in guitar?
Well, my parents weren't musicians, but my grandparents were, on my mother's side, were very, very famous, very well known and very well respected classical musicians. But it skipped a generation, I guess. In any case, my mother thought I'd look cute with a guitar when I was 10 years old, basically.
So, she was
so
right.
She got me a Stella guitar for, like, you know, $20 or something. And I sat there with it and struggled and struggled and struggled for a couple of years, played my stupid scales. And then I found the three chords with which you can play every rock and roll song, the one, the four, and the five. And at that point, the heavens opened. You know, the clouds parted, the sun came out, and that was it. That was it. I never looked back.
Cool.
Does that answer your question? I'm not sure.
I think so. Yeah, I think that's good. That's good. I don't play an instrument, so I'm fascinated. You know, the kids play instruments. My wife plays instruments. I'm just a fan of music, and it boggles my mind when I see them playing anything. So, you know, when I see you guys, it's off the charts. Wadi, do you have the same type of a story as Danny as far as playing guitar?
They didn't think I looked cute, no. and I had to agree with them. But I was always singing tunes. Even before I, you know, fell onto the guitar, I thought everyone did the same thing. I just was, any song I'd hear, I'd learn. And I was imitating singers and stuff like that when I was very young. And when I was 5 years old, I was standing next to my mom, and there was a big band show on television, black and white TV, and all of a sudden they cut to this guy that was sitting there playing this big jazz box, the big jazz guitar, and I just froze. I completely just was mesmerized by it, and I said to my mother, what is that? What's going on? What's happening here? What's he doing? What is that? What's that guy doing?" And she said, "He's playing a guitar." And I went, "Guitar? Okay, that's what I want." And she goes, "You're five." I said, "Yeah, well, that's what I want to do. That's what I'm going to do." And so it took till I was 9 years old and my father finally gave in and bought me a guitar. And I started taking guitar lessons at nine. So, but, you know, like I said, I thought everyone did the same thing. You know, everyone must be singing these same tunes. And they weren't.
Which sounds like
the guitar blew me away. I was just addicted the second I saw this guy playing it.
It sounds like you guys, for the most part, had supportive families in regard to you guys becoming musicians.
My dad fought me for years about it, but finally, I said, you know, from age five till nine, you know, 4 years of "Give me a guitar, damn it. Give me a ukulele." I said, you know, "I know how to count. There's only four strings on this. This is not a guitar. It's kind of small. You know, that thing was big." And
I had a very similar experience. As a matter of fact, that guitar there.
Yeah.
That's a 1964 Goya, and that's the one. And I had a very similar experience to Waddy. It just hit me like when I was about five. I saw a guy playing, and I begged them for it, and that they finally got me that guitar when I was eight or nine.
So the guitar that's behind you, Steve, that's the same guitar from when you were eight or nine?
That's a Goya nylon string that I got. That was my first guitar.
Well, I mean, unless you break a guitar, it's going to last forever, right? You take care of it, right?
Yeah.
How many, Leland, how many basses do you own?
I'm not a collector. I've probably got a dozen basses. But for the most part, they're all usable in my career. I really don't think an instrument should sit in a closet.
Yeah.
And there's bass players like, I think John Entwistle had like 600 basses, you know, because he covered walls with them. I mean, I was fortunate. He bought a bass of mine that I hated, but it looked beautiful. So he bought it from me and hung it. But I'm not a gearhead at all. Yeah, I pretty much have what I need. And I've gotten rid of a lot of stuff. I've given away stuff. If I have friends that have a kid that wants to learn bass, I figured it'd be nice for them to start on something decent rather than some piece of crap that could discourage them. So I've loaned a lot of instruments.
Oh, that's
out.
Nice. That's good. You know, pay it forward.
I just say, look, if you're not going to stay with it, I want it back. If you're going to stay with it, then you can have it.
I would stay with it. Russ, a drummer, you go on tour, you have one kit. You don't take a bunch of guitars, a bunch of basses with you. How many pieces are in the typical kit that Russ Kunkel would play on tour?
Well, there would be a kick drum, a snare drum, maybe two rack toms, a floor tom, four cymbals, hi-hat, a seat, and you'd carry an extra snare drum or two and an extra an extra pedal and some extra heads.
But for the most part, you can get all the sound out of that you need to do.
I don't even need that much.
Nice.
But yes. Yeah.
So when you see a rock band that's got a ridiculous, gigantic drum set, do you just shake your head like you don't need all that? Is that all for show?
Well, no. I mean, in the section, I played a much bigger drum kit.
Okay.
You know, and on the run in tour, I've gone down that road. But as I got wiser and older, I realized that, you know, you don't need all that, you know, so I've pared it down to just the basics.
I like how you added the word wiser in there. Waddy, I want to ask you about the Expensive Winos. You played with Keith in the Expensive Winos. And then in, I think, 97, you play on a Rolling Stones album. You kind of replace Keith on the song Sane of Me.
Thank you.
How does that happen? Does Keith say, I don't want to do it, get Waddy to do it? Or what's the story about that song?
All I knew was, I was on that Bridges album. We were there for 3 months every night. It was pretty astounding. And all of a sudden, Mick just came to me and said, come here, you got to play on this tune. You know, you got to play on this. So I went, why? He goes, just play on it.
Okay. So you're like an unofficial Stone.
Yeah, that's me. Yeah. Yeah. I'm very, very, very lucky. And very, I was amazed it happened. Jim Keltner and I were there together every night for like 3 months. It was astounding. We'd look at each other in the hallway going, we're still here, right? This is happening, you know.
And are they utilizing you and Jim Keltner every night? Or are you guys just, you're there if they need you?
Oh no, we were playing every night.
All right.
Yeah. Charlie would be playing the drums. Jim was set up next to him and he'd either be playing kid or he'd be playing shakers or sound, you know, other sounding things, other percussion things. And Keith and Woody and I we played on everything.
So what's it? When you meet, you know, because you're a successful musician, when you finally get to meet like Mick and Keith, and then you become friends with them, how do you separate like being a fan? Because I assume you're probably a fan of the Rolling Stones,
yeah.
You know, prior to becoming a successful musician. How long does it take until you're like, okay, now I feel like I'm a peer?
Well, you know, you're meeting a person, really. You got to put it in perspective. We just hit it off right away as dudes would. Mick Jagger and I got into like a little song, I can outdo you on the phrasing of this song kind of competition thing. Right away, we sat down at this party. I met them all through Linda, actually. Mick and Woody came to the show here in Los Angeles. And we went and hung out that night at someone's house and just had got to know each other that way. And then when we went to England with Linda, Keith was there after the show, came back downstairs and there's Keith Richards standing there and just went, oh, wow, Rolling Stone. And you're not much taller than me either. I like that. And he goes, hey, nice to meet you, man. And we spent the next 3 days just sitting around listening to music, playing guitars and smoking cigarettes and trying to stay as sober as one drunken night can keep you. And, we had a ball, you know, we just communicated as musicians and dudes rather than, all the accolades I could have laid on them. I chose not to, and, was really glad I didn't, you know, they are very, real guys. And if you get in a situation where you're one-on-one with them, you'll find that that's pretty much how they are.
Nice.
I know a lot of stuff, but they're just dudes. You know, I've seen them argue with each other. I've seen them, you know, the next day I saw them like, just like two kids at camp together. I'm going, who are you two? Weren't you, you know, at each other's throats last night or what? Nah, it's fuck that, you know, don't matter.
Fuck that.
You know, it's like not unlike Don and Phil Everly kind of, you know.
Yeah.
There's a communication between them that's no one can touch. So, you know.
Danny, a songwriting question for Danny again. And again, Danny, I'm not avoiding your guitar prowess. I know that I've been talking a lot of guitar with Waddy and a lot of songwriting with you, but I want to ask you a question. Was there a song that you wrote that became a hit that when just after you wrote it, you knew this is something, this is going to be something?
Well, you know, it's hard to know whether a song is going to be a hit or not. What I think about it, do I love it? Is it great? That's the only criteria I have for songs. I never say that's a hit. You know, some producers and a lot of A&R guys have used that expression, but I don't say that. I know it's really good and I know what I love, but whether other people are going to love it too, I'm never sure about. But I know when something is really, really good.
Gotcha. So calling something a hit would be more something that an A&R guy would do. You're just out to write the best song possible that you enjoy.
Yeah,
And I guess New York Minute's one of those because you guys put it on the EP.
Yeah.
And the version on the EP is great. I mean,
it's very different than the way Henley did it.
Yeah.
The way Henley did it was more jazzy and more restrained. And the way we do it is rock and roll. It's like a rock and roll ballad the way we do it, which I love. And the song holds up very well in that, with that treatment.
And did you always envision that song as more rock and roll?
sakes. That's what the band does. That's what we do.
Yeah.
That's how we play. So, yeah. It's, so everything we do comes out as rock and roll, no matter how it starts, it comes out as rock and roll.
Is that Henley? That's what I was going to say. Is that Henley giving you
a phone? Ask somebody else a question. I got to get that.
Take it.
I want to tell you something about Danny, in answer to what you were asking him about knowing it's a hit.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with him. You know, you just try to write the song, but when I went by his house and he played me, talking about Danny, the night I came by your place and you played me, All She Wants to Do Is Dance demo.
Yeah.
I said, this is a fucking smash. Mm-hmm. And the words weren't even on it yet, I don't think. It was mind-boggling. It was so great. It was destined to be a smash.
Picking up prisoners and putting them in a pen, and all she wants to do is dance, dance. Rebels been rebels since I don't know when. Kitchen sink, and all she wants to do is dance. Crazy people walking around with blood in their eyes, and all she wants to do is dance, dance, dance. Wild eyed pistol wavers who ain't afraid to die, and all she wants to do is, all she wants to do is dance.
And music.
I knew it was rocking. I knew it had a groove for sure.
And musically, All She Wants to Do Is Dance, it seems quite different from other things that you had done or participated in the past. I mean, it does have a dancey, you're giving me a look like, no, this is what I do. But listener, that's where I'm coming from.
I don't see it as that much of a departure from other stuff that I've done.
All right.
Because I just don't think that way, But I was definitely attracted to the idea of an ass shaker, shall we say.
Okay, I like that. All right.
And I wanted it to rock. I wanted it to have a big beat. And I think most of my tunes are like that. Most of my tunes have to have that rocking beat.
Hey, I want to give a shout out to Rob Shanahan, who did the photos for this EP. You guys look cool. These are great photos. You guys really look, you guys look
amazing
cool.
What they can do.
No, you all really do. These are great photos. You look tough in a couple. You look cool. I love it.
Rob's great.
Rob did a fantastic job.
He's the best.
Now, one last thing before we go. First of all, everyone go out and buy Slippin' and Slidin', and let's make this move up a couple more notches on the charts. We're at six. Let's keep going. And we all look forward to a full album, studio album from you guys, and you guys finally getting on the road. What are you guys doing during lockdown? Are you just playing on your own? What do you guys do to keep the chops up? You guys always play?
Yeah, we always play. All of us always play all the time, individually. What we do collectively has to be, like we do live streaming concerts. We've done a couple of those. We're going to do some more. And that kind of stuff. So basically, we keep busy, to the degree that we can, given the circumstances.
And doing the videos. We've been shooting our own material for the videos and having a great editor putting them together. So it takes up some time, too.
Leland and Russ, when you guys do these live streaming concerts, with the technology we have, you guys can get in sync and it feels like you're playing together?
No.
We've done three of them now. What are you talking about, when we're doing things individually or
no, when you're doing like a live stream and you're playing, you're all in separate places, but you're all playing together.
No.
Streams we do live. We filmed them as a band.
Okay. So you had
germs, so it's okay.
Gotcha. So yeah, you guys all have each other's germs, so you're cool. You can be together. I get it.
In the beginning, we did do some of the separate ones. We did a cappella videos where we were all doing our parts separately.
Okay.
And we do our parts separately when we make the videos. But in the end, it feels homogenous when we're finished with it.
Actually, New York Minute on the EP was done that way.
It was done separately, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. Final thing I would like to ask, we'll get some thoughts from all of you on the late, great Warren Zevon. I'll start with Russ. What can you tell my listeners something special about what it was like working with Warren.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is I really regret not getting to spend more time with him than I did. I mostly spent time with him in the studio, and it was a pure joy. He had the driest sense of humor. I mean, he was just the best. I mean, every time he opened his mouth, something brilliant came out, you know, and it was an honor to, be a part of making his music. Thanks to him and Waddy and Jackson for including me in those records.
Excellent.
Real pleasure.
Leland?
Exactly what Russ said. I feel exactly the same way.
Danny?
There was nobody like Warren. He was in a class by himself as a human being, as a songwriter in every way. One of the brightest people I ever met, actually. One of the absolute smartest individuals I had ever encountered. Very well-read, very intelligent. He knew a lot about a lot of stuff that, you know, he was just a very well-educated guy. He could talk on a lot of subjects. Brilliant, hilarious. I loved being around him. I got to hang out with him a lot after he gave up drinking for a while, and he was just a joy and a delight. Absolutely wonderful person to be around. Waddy spent the most time with him, though.
And so Waddy will go to you last, then, for that reason.
Oh, Steve, no. Steve, I don't know. Steve, got anything to say about Zevon?
I was making a record at A&M, and Waddy, you must have been there. And they said, you know, Warren Zevon's in the next studio. Want to go with Dan Nash? Brought me in there.
Oh, yeah.
And he was a figure unlike any all the rest of them. Like, he was so unique in his humor and intellect. And his persona, just being in the studio for a little bit of time, I wouldn't be surprised if Waddy had been in that room. But anyway,
no,
he was just someone that, because I've always looked up to people who, you know, used it, had brains going on as well as, but he was just unique and the coolest guy. I was just thought, there's the coolest guy I ever met.
Well, Steve, when you would read or hear a Warren Zevon lyric, you knew that there was that the brains were there.
Oh, yeah,
and the sense of humor.
So great. So great.
And Waddy, and thank you for pointing out that I missed Steve. So sorry, Steve. Waddy, you're last now on the Warren Zevon.
Well, everything everyone just said about him is completely false. He was a fucking pain in the ass. No, I'm kidding. He was a doll. He was an abstract, bizarre character. When we met, he was more committed to drinking than anybody I had ever come across in my life. I'd never seen anybody behave like that. But we spent a year on the road together with the Everly Brothers. And in that year, we bared a lot of resentment towards each other and argued about music every night, just about. But all night long, every night, we would get together and play either some great blues songs that he knew. We were both very addicted to country music, which was a perfect thing to do, because then we had he and I just learning and singing Merle Haggard songs all night long. And then Donald and Phil would wound up hanging out with us every night, and we'd just be singing beautiful music all night long. But he and I would argue constantly about songs, about music, about songwriters. The only things we agreed on were the Stones and Merle Haggard. But we developed this relationship where he'd write these songs, and I could hear how they should go down. I could arrange his stuff, not easily, but it made sense to me. Just hearing his tunes, I knew what to do with a band. And that was our relationship with that. And we went in for Excitable Boy. I had this whole cast of characters with me making this incredible record, and it was a joy. He and I, we butted heads a lot, and we got to a point where the album wasn't finished. I didn't think it was finished. There was a couple of songs on that record that I really thought should not be there. Jackson and Warren kind of clung to these two songs they had recorded before I got there. And I just kept saying, those songs don't make it, man. And sure enough, we had a playback party one night against my wishes. And side one went exactly as side one goes on that record. But side two had these two, as I called, duds on it. And by the time side two ended, most of the people that were at this playback party left. And I called a meeting with my two brothers and I said, all right, look, you see what happened? That's because of those two tunes. They got to go. And I'm leaving tomorrow to go out on the road with Linda, but I need two more songs from you, Warren. And I'm back in like a week and a half, and you got to have them ready because we got to get this thing finished. And I came back and I called him. I said, what's going on? He goes, I got him. What, you do? He goes, yeah, come on over. I come over and he plays me Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
Wow.
And plays me Tenderness on the Block. And we were just dying with joy together.
That's amazing.
I went home with a waitress the way I always do. I was gambling in Havana. I took a little risk. Send lawyers, guns, and money. Dad, get me out of this.
And it was so wonderful. And because I just got back from being on the road with Rick Marotta and with Kenny Edwards, we booked a session, went in the next day at 11 in the morning, and by 3 o'clock cut both those songs. And Warren and I spent a little time. I got to do a lot of guitar stuff on Tenderness on the Block that I really was very proud of and really happy with.
Mama, where's your pretty little girl tonight? Trying to run before she can walk. That's right, she's growing up. She has a young man waiting. She's growing up. She has a young man waiting. Tenderness on the Block.
And we were just in heaven, you know, we were loving it. And when the record company picked Werewolves, we were aghast. They were so right. And we were so wrong. We were so blinded by our, you know, excellent taste in music that we thought for sure one of these other tunes had to be the single. And they said, no, 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 Werewolves of London is the single. And we were so happy to be as wrong as we were.
Because now, I mean, it's iconic. You, everyone knows Werewolves of London.
Yeah, so we have a lot of time together, and I miss my crazy dear brother quite a bit.
Well, thank you, all of you, for sharing the memories and stories about Warren and all the stories today. I want to do a little promoting for you guys. You're on Twitter at the... I'm going to say Ahmed family. It's I-M-M-E-D family is on Twitter. And website's immediatefamilyband.com. The album is Slippin' and Slide, and you can get it everywhere. You can get physical copies. You can download it. And we didn't even talk about, hardly anything that you guys have done. Carole King, Stevie Nicks, Dan Fogelberg, Carly Simon. I mean, you guys have, it would take days to discuss everything that you guys have worked on and done and were successful at. Do any of you five, are you guys thinking about writing a book? Is anyone in the middle of writing a book? Waddy, yes or no?
No.
No. Danny?
The Immediate Family is our book.
That's it.
I love that the Danny is, he's all in on the Immediate Family. That's what you need. That's good. You should do it. That's how it should be.
Monovision.
Guys, thanks so much for doing this. This was a lot of fun. I hope you guys had fun. Thanks to Lisa Roy. She's amazing. And Steve, I'm going to use a song from the album as my playout song today. Do you want to choose it for me?
Before you do that, Steve, tell them what label it's on.
Oh, it's on Quarto Valley Records.
Quarto Valley Records.
And I would go with Slippin' and Slidin'.
All right, the title track of the EP, Slippin' and Slidin'. All right, you guys got it. Thank you so much, Russ Kunkel, Leland Sklar, Steve Postel, Danny Cooch Korchmar. I love your sly little grin, and Waddy Wachtel. I love you all. So thank you so much, guys. Take care.
Love you, brothers.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. I appreciate it. My pleasure. All right, I'm ending it. We'll wave. Goodbye.
Bought a man in the street, flipped his wings like a dove. He fell down to the ground, sliding deep in the mud. I got clouds in my eyes, blood on my hands, fire on my feet as I run to my love. Spit like a man. The wind blew through the bars in every prison land. My love is a cave, dark as a crow. I'm enslaved by her wisdom and her hips of gold. Slipping and sliding again. Yeah, I'm slipping. Sheets straight to an angel to kill the heat.